Hey, it's Eric G. Around the House is sponsored by Baldwin Hardware. For 75 years, Baldwin Hardware has been known for its first-class quality and craftsmanship in door and cabinetry hardware. As an alumnus of the Baldwin Hardware Design Council, I can say I have seen the details and quality from design to the finished product. If you're looking for a new style and old-world craftsmanship, I can tell you there is only one Baldwin Hardware. Check out what would look great in your home at baldwinhardware.com.
When it comes to remodeling and renovating your home, there is no better show on your radio. This is Around the House with Eric G.
Everybody stop what you're doing, please!
From your back fence to the sidewalk, Eric will tell you how to keep it all in tip-top shape while helping you save a buck while doing it. If you like DIY projects, it takes a lot of practice to get good at it, and Eric is here to guide the way.
These are the wrong plans! These are the old plans!
All that and more on the fastest 2 hours of home improvement radio.
Stop it! Stop what you're doing!
Welcome to Around the House with Eric G.
Welcome to Around the House with Eric G. This is the midweek special. This is where we talk about stuff that didn't make it into last week's show and won't make it into next week's show. Now, we have a special version today. This is our clubhouse that we're going to start premiering on Mondays when we record them. So this won't be every Monday, but when we have that clubhouse event on Thursdays, which is 9 a.m. Pacific over in Clubhouse, called Around the Home. Now, we have teamed up with the Homeowners Show. You have caught them probably on podcasts out there. They're a great show out of South Texas that we have teamed up with. Those guys are awesome. And so we have a lot of fun, and we do a clubhouse room every single Thursday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific. So I wanted to tease ahead so we can get more people in tomorrow. If you're on Clubhouse on Apple, if you don't know what Clubhouse is, it's an app that you can sit there and talk and chit-chat with people of all different subjects. It's unfortunately right now only on iOS, so it's Apple only. But I'm sure that for the rest of you, the rest of the half of the country, in the world that doesn't use Apple, that will be coming soon. But you'll be able to catch these when we record them here. So I wanted to tease you with our new clubhouse that we've been doing. And you can jump in and ask questions, ask DIY questions, ask all that. We're just doing this on a different social media platform, which is kind of fun. So you can always catch us on Clubhouse on Thursdays. That's when I'm on there all the time as well, but that's really where you'll see this room at 9 a.m. Pacific. And you can, noon Eastern, 11 Central, you know the routine here. So check us out on Clubhouse. This is where we're going to have some fun from time to time, hopefully about every week as long as everything goes correctly. Sometimes schedules get in the way because it's live. I'll either be there or I won't, but this is how this is going to work. So let's head over to our Clubhouse room, and you can take a look and listen to how Clubhouse works and how people exchange ideas and chit-chat and talk back and forth. Now let's get to the show. All right, everybody, let's reset the room here for the first discussion we've ever had about real estate law. Welcome to Around the Home. Let's talk a little bit about what you need to know about real estate law. This is one of those things that I've realized with my national radio show that things are different in every single state. What happens out in my country is completely different in my side of the state versus other parts, and this is a great discussion for everybody out there with real estate, because what flies in one area, I've learned, doesn't fly in another. Let's get this conversation going. Craig and Kevin, welcome to the room here as well.
Hey, thanks, man. Good to be here. Glad to get talking about this. It's going to be good.
We've also got Michael, Deborah, and Nick in here as well. Thanks, guys. You know, it's interesting. I had a discussion in my area. I'm in Oregon State, so I'm in Portland, Oregon area, and real estate law, when it comes down to here, is done completely different than my friend, Carolyn Bozowski. She was trying to buy a home, and here everything is done between a realtor and the potential homeowner, and then there's the mortgage company that's involved, as well as the title company,
And really, that's all that happens within a typical standard real estate transaction, where in New Jersey, where she is from, they have their real estate deal, but a third-party real estate attorney has to be part of the process. So it's fascinating to me how things in the United States can be so different just from state to state.
Yeah, it's absolutely crazy. I mean, I know that states have different reasons for doing those kinds of things, but I'm curious to know from Michael, because I know he is a real estate attorney. Michael, what state are you actually operating in?
I'm in Arizona, and part of the reason I'll answer that question already. Part of the reason that some states have different rules and otherwise for how a real estate transaction closes is because, and I know this at least back east, some lawyers provide title insurance, whereas at least in the state of Arizona, you have to go to a title company to get that. And so that is why in some states you can do a real estate transaction without counsel. And Arizona is one of those. You do not have to have a real estate lawyer to do a deal. It's probably advised if you've got an issue with your contract and you don't know what to do in the middle of escrow, that you call counsel and figure out what your options are. But that is not a requirement in this state. And I can't necessarily speak about others. I'm only licensed in Arizona. Traditionally, real estate law and business is kind of universal among the 48 states. But it doesn't mean that there are quirks in other places that we don't have here and otherwise.
Yeah, it might actually be helpful. At least I know for like Kevin and I, who like, you know, and possibly Eric, but Eric knows a lot more than we do. But like, what is the purpose of title insurance in that regard? Because I know people always get it, but like I don't think a lot of people actually know like what it is and what it does for you.
Well, if you are buying property from John Smith and you don't get title insurance, you've got to hope that John Smith has good and valuable, reputable title to that property that they're selling you. And so if you enter into a purchase contract with John Smith and then the title company does their due diligence, they will insure the money you pay to John Smith via the insurance policy, title insurance policy. If somewhere down the line you find out that you actually don't own the property, or there's some issue with the property that you don't have total ownership, or maybe there's an easement over it, or whatever the policy covers. And basically, that means, you know, say John Smith enters into a purchase contract with you, and, you know, you put your escrow money down, blah, 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 and then all of a sudden John Smith goes out and puts a fixed loan against the property. That's something that title insurance would prevent against, and they would either take the funds and pay off that amount that's loaned against it, or, you know, they would file an action for him for fraudulent and everything else, stuff like that. That's kind of the point of one of the many benefits of title insurance.
So I've got a question.
So you're talking about like if – go ahead, Eric. Go ahead.
I just had a question with Michael. I'm hearing on the radio and TV and stuff now, I'm hearing people talk about title theft insurance as well, where they're saying scammers are stealing people's titles. That's something completely different. Have you heard of that happening out there in your travels? I haven't either.
And
something interesting, I tried to track this stuff down because I heard, I'm like, how is somebody stealing somebody's title? And I guess, you know, anybody can steal anything if they try hard enough out there. They quote some FBI statistics in this ad. This is a national ad. It's not like some weird little thing. And where they quote the FBI, I called my local FBI office and they hadn't heard about it. They looked into it and hadn't heard about it either. So it's very interesting that be careful when you get into some of these things outside of it, of a real estate transaction. But you're right, Michael. Having that clear title is a big deal, and all it takes is liens or anything like that, and you got a mess if that wasn't done properly.
I mean, one of the reasons when people get title insurance is because when they turn around X amount of years later to sell the property, they don't want to have a problem popping up on title that says, hey, you're not the full record owner. By the way, you've got to go get X person's permission to do this. And so that's kind of the reason you want to do that. So it prevents any issues down the line. So you have maintained clear ownership.
Have you ever run into situations where, and I've run into this before too, where you're buying from I know somebody that was trying to buy from a nonprofit. That property had been donated to that nonprofit. The nonprofit down the road decides to sell it, but they find at the time of title, when they're going through that stuff, that they realize the title company had found that there was a buyback notation that they had first right of refusal for that donation. Have you ever run into that kind of stuff before with properties when they've exchanged hands?
I have not personally run into a situation like that, but I have I know someone that actually made a good amount of money on a situation like that, where he did have a first right of refusal against some property, which at the time of the deal, most people thought was meaningless. And then I want to say about 15 years after the fact, and if anyone knows North Phoenix, this property was somewhere in North Phoenix, and no one ever thought it would be worth much. And then 20 years later, the town developed northward, and someone went to go put an offer on this property, and my guy exercised his right of first refusal and ultimately made them, it was like, give him $1 million just to exercise his purchase right. That was what he wanted. And it was, I don't remember exactly the details, because it was way before I ever became an attorney, but he told me what happened and basically said that he made a good amount of money just for sticking this clause in his document that he had no intention of ever exercising, but just in case someone else might want to, he wanted to stick it in there. And so I don't want to say that's a common thing, but it can happen.
Wow. Thanks,
man. And that's something that typically title would pick up when they do their title report, because their job as a title company is to find every impediment or encumbrance upon title that they can. And so if they don't find something, and usually they'll have in their policy some things about unrecorded liens and this and that and the other, which they're exempt from. But basically, if you have a recorded instrument against a piece of property, that title company is supposed to pick it up on their report.
That's interesting.
Yeah, Eric and Michael, I was kind of, when you were talking about title theft, I was kind of wondering if that's maybe like the new phraseology that they're using around, maybe some fraudulent liens that people are putting against pieces of property in order to, like, you know, maybe sneak in the back door almost.
I would guess it's just someone signing a bogus deed back and forth to someone else just to try to get on title. And that would be my guess as to what it is. But I've never heard of this thing that we're talking about.
Yeah, I did.
I hadn't heard of it either, though.
Yeah, I did as best a job as I could find out, because I heard this ad, and I've heard this ad probably hundreds of times. There's a bunch of no politics here, but I heard a bunch of conservative talk show hosts and people talking about it in the endorsements, and I went, ah, that's weird. What's that story? And I could find no proof of it out there that from any legitimate source that was happening. So that made me very curious about, a quote-unquote insurance policy on something that technically doesn't really happen.
Yeah, in California, actually, I purchased my home last year, and I checked my mailbox just last week, and the state department, I forget which one, but the state government sent me a card asking, did you go and like do a change of title or refi, because there's been fraud? So if you haven't done anything, contact us. If you did something, ignore this letter. And I also watched my local board of supervisors meeting, and this woman last year came on multiple times talking about the issues she'd had with her title being like stolen or whatever, and the board was very impassive. I mean, I guess they sort of have to be, but like they didn't even show any empathy. So I don't know if they met with her privately afterwards, but like from the facial expression, like, I mean, not just the words, they just look like, oh, whatever. So at least in the state of California, it seems like it is happening. I don't know how prevalent it is, or, you know, what is there a specific type of property or home that they're targeting? But the fact that I got a letter from the state government, and I mean, I did a refinance, so that was what triggered it. But it was like really scary at first. And then I read through it. It was like, yeah, if this is what the document says and you did a refinance, you're good. And both of those aligned, and I did a refinance. So But it was really freaky getting the letter at first, to be honest, before I read through it.
Anytime I get a letter like that, I'm almost immediately suspicious because I feel like someone's trying to, like a Venus flytrap, draw me in to some sort of scam. I mean, I think that's the unfortunate state of a lot of things right now. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's why I was freaked out. But then when I saw that it had all, like, the official stuff and, you know, it was from the right, like, it wasn't, like, fraudulent. Like, so, but yeah, that was my initial inclination that either I was being alerted that something had occurred fraudulently, or, like you said, it could be some sort of mail phishing or whatever. Yeah.
Well, and just real quick, so everybody down in the audience knows, this is Around the Home Club. And if you have any questions for anybody up here on the panel, we'd be happy to answer them and or just have any sort of conversation about legal issues going on with real estate.
So, Michael, I had a question for you here. What do you recommend for people out there that are, you know, you see people that are going through the transaction and they're following all the rules and they're using a realtor and going through what's the typical process in their area? And then you see people out there that are doing just a private transaction. What is your recommended way to go through that transaction between two parties when maybe you don't have a realtor that's involved in the process and you're just trying to navigate it?
Well, and the realtors in this room may not like my comments here, but I don't think realtors are necessary. I mean, I also don't think a lawyer is even necessary if you are understanding of what's going on and you are familiar with the real estate documents and you know how to read the easements, you know how to read CC&Rs and all the other things that will pop up on title, because if you understand those items, then there's no need to hire counsel. A real estate contract, at least in the state of Arizona, I can't speak for anyone outside of it. The Arizona Association of Realtors has put together a form contract for the purchase and sale of real estate. That's both residential and commercial. And the form contract, it's okay. But the issue is the realtors in Arizona, you have to have a realtor in order to put your property up on MLS. And so therefore these realtors believe that they're integral to the transaction, when in all reality, and this is where I might be getting mean, they take some photos, they put it up on the internet, and they wait for a buyer to come in and put on an offer down, and then the escrow officer then effectuates the transaction. The realtor is not really necessary. And so, at least in Arizona, it's not something you need as the transaction proceeds. It's kind of necessary at the outset just to get the property up. Then once the deal's in escrow, most of the parties can act on their own. At least that's my view of it. Where I come in is when someone misses a deadline or there's an issue with title that needs to be cleared up before the seller or the buyer wants to proceed. You know, someone can't get financing, so we've got to get a delay to get that taken care of. You guys all know the common types of things that cause an escrow to be delayed, and that's where I kind of come in to help fix those types of problems. Does that answer the question?
It really does, and it maybe that's a little controversial for some, but I like your perspective on that.
It's hard to answer those questions because there could be 50 different state viewers here, and so the rules in each state is different. I'm only allowed to speak to what I know, and that's Arizona, because I'm the only place I'm licensed. And I know in other states there are completely different rules, and so I just don't know what those are and what the requirements for those types of deals.
No, I get it. Like, for instance, here in Oregon where I'm at, we have to have usually a radon inspection, and I think a sewer scope is required by law. But I know in other states, like down in Texas, you start getting into pest control, and I know Craig and Kevin can speak to that as well.
See, you just hit on one thing that in Arizona I know is different. In the Arizona form contract that the realtors use, a sewer hookup is what they've deemed a mandatory inspection item if the buyer is concerned about it. And the only reason I know this, well, I've read the contract and I've seen the language, but about a month or two ago, I had a client come to my office who sold the property, and in his disclosures, he said there was a sewer hookup. The reason he disclosed it that way is because when he bought the property 10 years prior, that's how the property was disclosed to him. He never bothered to look. He's a dentist, not a plumber, so he didn't have any business scoping down there or whatever. So anyway, he sold the property a few months back, and the person that bought it did not do an inspection. And in bold language in the document, it says, if this is material to you, you have to do it. So then several months back, my guy gets a demand letter saying, hey, there's no sewer connection here. You owe $75,000. And so we just told him to go pound sand based on the contract. And they were alleging some other things that they were being untruthful about. But then we ended up settling the matter for like $3,000 because this guy was full of it and the contract didn't allow him the right he was trying to enforce. And so we just told him, good luck. You're welcome to sue us, but you're going to lose. And so that resolved the problem. But that was one thing that, at least in this state, if you want a sewer connection, you have to look it up yourself. And it's not something that's assumed or you have to do.
Yeah, wait, we ran into it. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, bud.
I was just curious. Like, did they not live in the home, like the dentist or the buyer? Because I would think if you even just, you know, were renovating or whatever, you'd use the restroom and you'd find out, you know, there's nothing connected, or, you know, there'd be like a septic line somewhere on the property.
Yeah. That is interesting because, and that was one of the questions that I asked as well. And because during my client's ownership of this property, he actually remodeled the property and added a bathroom. Now, he physically didn't do it. He hired someone to do it. There was also like a neighbor in the area that was a semi-handyman. So I'm not sure of the confidence level of these guys. But ultimately, the remodel was completed and it worked. And according to them, this is the story that I got. They had no idea the property was on septic, and based on their usage of the bathroom, it didn't appear that there was any issue with it. And then when they did the remodel, there were no issues there, so they had no reason to assume that it was connected that way. And so that was their excuse, if you will. The other thing in my brief scenario that I didn't tell everyone is my guy was an investor. He bought this property. He was intending to live there, but as soon as he bought it, he got a job in Sweden or something like that. So he just up and moved. And so he never actually occupied the property that we're talking about here. He was kind of an outside owner investor who then decided, well, I've got to do something with it. He leased it out for a few years before he had ultimately said, this is not something I intend to do long term. Let's just get rid of it.
Interesting.
When you mentioned septic system, my brain immediately wanted to go to, because I know here in Texas, a lot of people are being forced to move over to an anaerobic system. Is that something you guys are having to go through there as well?
I don't know what an anaerobic system is, so I'm going to say no.
Ah, we don't need realtors though. Ah, Michael. Okay. So I would love to pop in here just briefly and say hello, everyone. And Michael, I do appreciate, you know, your comments there. And unfortunately, okay, so I'm in Texas. Texas is also a title state. We don't have to have an attorney representing buyer or seller. We do have title company involved, and obviously similar to, as Eric mentioned, mortgage as well, if, of course, it's a finance deal. But I definitely appreciate your comment about, you know, that due diligence that is required on the buyer's end. And, you know, commonly, of course, the realtor is going to walk them through that. Like, here are the types of inspections that we might would do on an investment style home. Because obviously these people never did occupy it. They've given us a statement of what they believe, you know, they know about the property, material defects, et cetera. However, you know, these inspections need to be paid for by professionals, and you need to know everything about it and have a full picture of your home, because, again, on the back side of that, you know, you come out with a no sewer line attached, and you can't win litigation that way. You have to have known, you know, you have to have done your own due diligence up front, because obviously that seller was not in full knowledge.
Yeah, Deborah, I'm actually curious, because I know in years past, like the inspections that I mainly are involved in are the what they call the WDOs now, the wood destroying organisms. And banks used to require those, and I know that they're not anymore. But I think part of that is because it's, you know, and this is where someone like Michael comes in. Is it's one of the more litigious parts of real estate in Texas. So are you seeing banks, you know, press on those? I know they are on VA loans, but not. I'm wondering if you're seeing it more on some other traditional.
Yeah. So I haven't seen it on a conventional loan yet. I've had an FHA loan question us about it, but didn't require it. I always recommend that my clients do have, you know, the pest, you know, the WDI inspection as well. But of course, yeah, VA is the only one that does actually require it. My area of Texas has black clay soil, and so we actually tend to have, you know, quite high incidence of, you know, subterranean WDI. And yeah, I do think it maybe even should be more required, but definitely should be inspected every single time. That's always my recommendation, is every single time.
Yeah, we've actually had a similar situation to what Michael was talking about, where we had a new homeowner, and this was a while back, but still, reach out to us. You know, I say reach out to us, that's the kind way of putting it. sent us a letter saying that, you know, essentially saying their intent to sue on a previous treatment, which we actually hadn't even done. We just happened to be the most recent company that had been on their property, and they were just, you know, hey, we got termites now, and this treatment was done 20 years ago, and now we have them again, and so we're going to sue you. And, you know, similar to Michael, we kind of told them to go pound sand. But like it, that, even with the inspection sometimes, you know, like it seems like people are willing, because it's such an expensive, you know, investment, that they're just willing to, like, take you to court. I mean, it's pretty crazy.
You know, I've got a loophole here I want to ask everybody to see if they've got any input on, because it's something that in my area homeowners are getting caught in an ugly kind of way. So let's say they're out looking at a, and I'll use Portland, Oregon, where I'm at as an example, because I'll use the story that happened that I witnessed. Homeowner went out and went through the process, purchased a 2,100 square foot house is what the listing was for. Tax assessment said 2,100 square feet. They bought the house, moved in, started living there. Everything seemed great. They went and pulled a building permit, and the house, since it had a converted attic into bedrooms and bathrooms and the finished basement, was only listed by the building department at 775 square feet. So they actually bought and financed a home that was 700 square feet that they thought was over 2,000. And they got caught in between about unpermitted work that, quite frankly, now that when they went to do those remodels, they had to turn around and spend over $100,000 to get it up to current code. Are there any recommendations outside of somebody just doing their own due diligence to make that part of the process?
I mean, like, when I was looking for a home, more for like investment properties than just my own home, I would look up the title, just go to the county, and there's going to be a system where you can go and look up each house and just like verify what the county records it as actually being. And then also, at least in California, you can go and like request all of those requisite documents. I'm not a lawyer or a realtor, but I bought a house, so that's what I know.
Yeah, what I run into is that the county tax assessor or the city tax assessor, whoever your municipality is, they will tax you for as many square footage as you will allow them to put on there, but it's not a reflection of actually what the building department says that the actual square footage of the house is. So the tax assessor might be tied in with the title, but the title company and all these people aren't talking to the building department for what was actually permitted and what they consider the legal square footage of the house is. And it's an interesting little place for people to fall in the cracks with.
That's really interesting. I mean, I have a condo, so it's standard. So it's like you have to do is look and see what the size of the other models are, and then you'll know, you know, approximately what your square footage is. But yeah, if it's a standalone home and they've, especially if it's older, yeah, you could have a dramatically different square footage. And that was one of the things, like, when I was looking for houses, there would be a listing on, like, Realtor that said, like, 3 beds, 3 baths. And I go there and I'm like, well, where's the 3rd bath? Or 3 bed, 2 baths? Or where's the 2nd bath? You know, and, like, people will have these very interesting, unpermitted additions and alterations. And I actually turned down one house because they had a bunch of unpermitted wiring that was sort of a fire and, you know, shock hazard. And I would have needed to go and fix all of it. And I was just like, not for my first house. Sorry.
No, I get it. It's an interesting trap. Michael, do you have any suggestions on how to navigate that legally throughout the process? I know, I always recommend people do their own due diligence on this. Is there any other way to put that stuff in a contract or something to make sure that you're covered?
So I wasn't really paying attention the last 2 minutes. I'm responding to some emails. But generally speaking, you can put a carve out for whatever you want in a contract as long as the other side agrees to it. The only caveat to that would be if the state in which you are doing the deal has a provision that prohibits whatever you're trying to stick in the contract, then it would be void.
Yeah, we were just talking about to catch up to speed, just the loophole of people buying a house that the listing agent puts up as, you know, let's say 2,400 square feet. The tax assessor says 2,400 square feet, and the building department says it's 775 square feet. And how do you get that? How do you keep that from being a problem down the road? Because I had another project that I was a designer on that it was a master bath remodel that we actually got a permit from the city of Portland. It was great. The contractor goes in there, guts the bathroom. Inspector walks up. Permits are all on the board. Inspector walks upstairs and says, hey, when they remodeled this 40 years ago, nobody pulled a building permit. And they had to bring it up to 2018 code, which cost them an additional $120,000, including tearing up the finished basement to put new footings in for the structural and ventilation that required for 2019 building code. They had to treat that upper floor like it was a brand new addition.
Gotcha. Okay, well, I've got a couple of comments to that. In Arizona specifically, you can look up any permit on file, and the city will send it to you, at least if it's within this municipality. I don't know about Scottsdale otherwise, but in Phoenix, that's the case. And so when you are doing your due diligence, you could figure out if anything was permitted or not. And then to the extent something on that property, it was built and was unpermitted, you then can go back to your seller and negotiate the purchase price, you know, should you choose to do so. It's interesting that that was kind of the example you mentioned, because and my personal residence, I bought at a bit of a discount because there was a legal issue with it that no one bothered to investigate. And it wasn't that my house had a proper addition that wasn't permitted. It was all permitted. But it was so close to the property line. And 40 years ago at my property, the neighbors hated each other. And so they built their houses right next to one another as kind of a silent war. And so that's kind of what the issue was. And then X amount of years later, when I bought, I kind of inherited it. And it's a non-issue, at least in my view, because at least in Arizona, when the city does make a change to their building code and whatnot, depending on the type of property, and I've got a residential property, a lot of those changes will be grandfathered in. And so you will not have to update your property to accommodate such, depending on the issue. And one of the issues is, like, I have a swimming pool at my house and I have a fence around it, but if I were to remove my fence, I wouldn't be a problem because I have a secondary kind of gate around my whole backyard. So that would be satisfactory in the state's view. And so, I don't know, I've been talking a while. Does that answer the question?
It sure helps me. So what other, here's the thing,
It definitely answered it for me.
Yeah.
Sorry, Kevin, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I think that answered the question for sure. I want to move off to something else that I've had a question about for a while. We're actually looking to purchase some property and for my family, but we'd also like to move my mother-in-law onto that property as well. And so she owns a home currently, and she owns it outright. We still have a mortgage on our property. And so we're considering selling both of those, purchasing that property. What I've found specifically, Michael, I'm interested in hearing from you. What I've really found here is that there's a lot of things that we have to consider, both from a kind of a life expectancy type of place for what happens whenever she passes away, and how those things pass on when it comes to those types of things. But just from a legal state of purchasing something together versus, you know, purchasing it separate, what advice would you have for someone who is trying to do that type of transaction?
And you're just talking about a transaction in which you're selling a property, you have a relative that's selling a property, and you're going to buy a joint property together?
Yeah, that's correct.
Find a house that you're all happy with. In terms of, I guess there's some more questions that have to be asked, like life expectancy. How long do y'all expect to live together? How long do you expect before this elder person kind of drops off? And then, you know, what are the plans for ownership of that person's interest moving forward? Do they have any other heirs that they want to be giving an interest to? Are you guys the only ones? How's the financing arrangement going to work, if any? So some of those questions have to be answered, but ultimately, and I guess it's kind of, there's a simple way to answer the question. Are you assuming you guys are either all going to hold title together, or just the husband and wife are going to hold title together and kind of just rent out space to the mother-in-law or the mother, or even just let her live with them rent free? I guess that's kind of what your issue is going to be. True?
Yeah, exactly. These are all kind of things we're trying to think through, because it seems like the real, you know, the simplest way to do it would be that my wife and I would purchase the property and allow her to live there. Now, whether that means that we sell her a portion of the property, because, you know, here's where kind of the
I wouldn't sell her a portion of the property, because as soon as she dies, you're going to have to clean it up.
Yeah, so... you know, part of the issue there becomes, you know, she needs the money that she gets off of the sale of her house to go back into real estate to not pay taxes on it, right? So if that's the case, then we have to try to find a way to, you know, put her into that property. And the easiest way to do that is put her on title. That being said, we don't really want her on title for future things. So, you know, is there a way to then later at some point down the road, remove her from title, or is it a sense where we could potentially sell her a piece of that property and then turn around and buy it back from her? You know, I think there's a couple of different ways that potentially could be done. I just don't know what the best legal way to do that would be.
So, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like when your mom or mother-in-law sells their property, they're going to be hit with some type of capital gains tax. True?
Yeah, if she doesn't put that back into real estate, okay, then yeah, she'll have to pay tax on that. Correct. And so in order to avoid a substantial tax,
the way to get around that would be is when your mom or mother-in-law decides to sell, then within 6 months, she's going to want to do what's called a 1031 exchange. And you'll have to get a special 1031 exchange agent to handle that type of transaction, because there's a number of intricate laws that have to be followed in order to do that. But basically, you have to have the property that you want to buy already picked out, and then you have them hold the funds. And you know how 1031 works, I'm assuming. That would be the way that I would get rid of her property and then acquire a new one. And then you guys would then have to probably talk to a will or a trust person and also an accountant about how you can then figure out about transferring the property from her to you, whether it's during her lifetime or sometime through the estate when she passes, if it's better for tax reasons that way, because it's a function of how much is the value of the property, and then what other assets are in the estate, and then how to avoid tax on such. And so one way to do it might be to put you guys on title altogether and then do what's called joint tenants with rights of survivorship. At least in Arizona, that means if you have multiple people that are entitled to a property and one of them dies, their interest automatically reverts to the surviving owners. So that's probably a situation where you want to find yourself in some point down the line, but we've got to talk to an accountant or someone else to help you get there to avoid the capital gains issue with the 1031.
Yeah, so I don't know.
What's the time frame on those? Sorry, just real quick.
180 days for a 1031 exchange.
There you go. That's what I was wondering.
So what? I don't know what the 1031 exchange is. You mentioned that. Can you speak to that real quick?
Yeah. So 1031 exchange, at least in the state of Arizona, is a vehicle designed for people that make a successful property investment to delay the tax hit to some other future point down the line. So they don't have to pay taxes right when they buy and sell every piece of property so they can continue to grow their business. For example, John Smith buys a parcel of land for $100,000. Then X amount of time goes by and they find oil under the property or gold or what have you, and now the property is worth $1 million. And so that's a $900,000 increase in value. So John Smith goes to sell the property. He does not want to be stuck with paying a capital gains hit, $900,000, and having to pay tax on that. So what he does is he would acquire and engage the services of a 1031 agent, and then John Smith would have to then go around, figure out what other property he was going to buy with those monies. And there are particular rules for 1031 exchanges. You have to buy a property within a certain price range of the selling property so the monies can be appropriately applied. There's some ranges where you can go up or down that, and if you go above, you always have to add new money to the deal. But then once the appropriate property has been identified, you enter into a purchase contract, and ultimately the 1031 exchange agent kind of like acts like a special escrow officer to ensure that the buyer, the seller of the first property, buyer of the second property, i.e. the person doing the 1031 exchange, doesn't get use of those funds in their individual capacity so they can just run off with it. And so that's kind of the concept of the 1031 exchange. It avoids that tax hit and pushes it down the line to later whenever that person decides to sell that secondary property, then they'll have to pay the taxes. And you can push that off infinitely down the line.
Okay. I know you can only speak to Arizona, but you can do that in Texas as well.
Yeah, I think you can do it in most places because I've heard it's very common. And you can 1031 from selling a property in Arizona to buying it in Texas or otherwise, as long as you've got an agent that can handle the transaction for you.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. And you know, you mentioned that joint tenants with rights of survivorship. That actually makes a lot of sense as well. You know, we just want to make sure she does have a co-heir. It's just you know, it would be my wife and one other person. But you never know. I mean, things get crazy, and so we want to make sure that we're protected and we do things in a smart way, but also something that's in a very legal way, you know?
Well, and it is important because when someone dies and I'm not a wills and trust guy, but depending on the state that you live in, if the person that dies doesn't have a will, then it reverts back to the statutory rules. And depending on where you are, that distribution could become, I believe what's called per stirpes, which basically says, okay, you've got someone that dies, you take every living relative they have at that time, and they get a portion of that distribution based on the rules and what their lineage is. And so usually, you know, defaults to children or a spouse, then it goes to siblings, then to cousins, and blah, blah, blah. But the reason it's important is because, at least in my, I've been doing this 10 years, I've had a number of people come to me, and they don't know where their kids are. They've lost touch with them over time. And I, in addition to being sad, it's just kind of odd because I had a client, and this why I'm bringing this up, about 2 or 3 months ago, I had a guy who was planning his end of life estate. And so he was trying to figure out, okay, I got all my properties in the trust. I need to give the trust now to my kids. And so he was asking me to help him with that. And I'm like, okay, well, in Arizona, in order to do that, you've got to identify the beneficiaries, where your kids live. And he only knew where one of his three kids was. He didn't even know if two of them were alive at this point in time. And so that's why it's kind of important to have your estate settled and your title. Go ahead.
No. I think that I jumped in here and I didn't mean to. I meant to, but I thought that you had stopped what you were saying. So I think I interrupted. I apologize.
To wrap up, it's important to know where everyone is because you don't want the state deciding where the property ownership is going to go. So that's why you want to have proper title to your asset, because if someone does bite the dust, then if you have the appropriate documentation lined up, the state's not going to get involved. A la if you have your joint tenants with rights of survivorship on your deed, and then mom dies, it goes right to the other owners of the property rather than having to go through probate.
That sounds really good. We've already gone through some of that with our with the attorney to do a will and those sorts of things. So some of we've been trying to work through those things as well. So I think we're on the right track, and it sounds like it's a matter of making sure that things line up. Even if we put her on title, so that title reverts to us, and then it doesn't have to go through probate. And then we can figure the rest out with the will.
Yeah, that's just to kind of go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, that's really smart. I mean, you know, anything can go sideways when you have a loss of a family member, family emotion, and then inject the legal system into it. You want to see what you can do to navigate that on the front end, because otherwise you're stuck reacting to it.
Yeah, and if I'm understanding Michael correctly, the situation you could potentially run into is, you know, say Kevin, you know, buys a piece of property joint title with his mother-in-law, and, you know, she, you know, unfortunately passes away early, and she, you know, she has a knucklehead for a son that's his brother-in-law. Well, if she doesn't have her affairs in order, you know, Kevin could be, you know, saddled with this knuckle brother-in-law, you know, until they dissolve the property. And like, that doesn't sound like any fun at all.
Yeah, and ultimately that's really, I mean, not that that's going to happen with us, because we don't have a knucklehead brother-in-law, thankfully. But, you know, those types of things happen, and you never know what might happen down the line. I mean, currently he's not married. You know, maybe he gets a wife and she becomes a knucklehead. And so then it becomes crazy even then. But just trying to – I think this is one of the things, and part of the reason I'm bringing this up, Michael, is because I'm genuinely curious, because we are going to be doing this at some point. But – just to kind of let people know, like, there's a lot of things out there that I think that people just think, oh, I'll just go buy a house. And it's not quite as easy as that. And sometimes talking with a real estate attorney can really clear up some things. Hopefully, if you do choose to get an agent, then that person will point you to the right people to make sure you're getting the right information. And if that person isn't, hopefully your mortgage lender is going to be smart enough to protect you on some of those sorts of things. But just the protection there is just super, super important. And I think that's one of the good reasons we're talking about this today, is just to go, look, at the end of the day, you don't want to get saddled with something that you can't get out from under, or that you've done something that now legally you're responsible for that you never intended to be legally responsible for. And just to make sure that your bases are covered, because this is a huge transaction, most likely the largest that you'll ever make. And there's no point in being dumb about that whenever you could spend just a couple of dollars talking to a real estate attorney. And I realize that's probably grossly underfunded. But just to kind of give you an idea that it's worth the money to make sure that you're doing things correctly.
Great point. Hey, just wanted to reset the room a little bit here. We got a bunch of new people that have been joining in. We've been talking real estate law and what you need to know. This is the Around the Home Club here. Make sure you swipe down. Make sure that everybody's seeing everybody that's in here. If you want to talk, if you have questions, if there's something that you already are wondering, how do I get around this? Now's the time to ask it. Step up and we'll put you up here to ask that question.
Yeah, and while we're waiting for people to jump up on stage and potentially ask some questions, I wanted to circle back around to something we were talking about earlier, which was, getting the property value, and talking about, you know, how that affects your taxes. And but the other thing that I think, especially right now, that people need to consider when you're talking about, you know, when you get your property valued, you know, that affects the premiums on your homeowner's insurance, which, you know, that's part of the reason a lot of people fight it, is because they're trying to help keep those premiums down. Well, like right now, what that ends up affecting is how much those insurance companies are able to disperse to you. You know, if anything catastrophic happens, you know, like whether that be a fire or a flood, you know, depending on the kind of insurance that you have, and especially right now with the cost of building materials, like it seems like even though you don't want to pay those high premiums, it's almost like you would want your house to be valued higher just so that if something did happen, you could potentially cover the cost to rebuild that home or recover the costs there. And I know here, you know, one of the things that we're allowed to do is actually contest those things. And I'm kind of curious from, you know, from everyone up on the stage, you know, have you guys run up against that? I mean, I know Deborah and Lorna, you guys are dealing with it here in Texas. Michael, I don't know how that works in Arizona, but I mean, like it's something I've had cause for concern, for recently, just because I know that, our property has, I think it's jumped in value almost like $150,000 just within the last 6 to 8 months. And so while I don't want to pay those premiums, I'm concerned if something happens to my home that my insurance company may not be able to cover it.
You know, many of us are running into that right now, Craig, and that's one of the things that, you know, with lumber prices being 300% higher, and so many other building materials out there right now, if you had your house properly insured with a replacement value policy 18 months ago, the chance of you being very underinsured right now is high. And then you also need to take into account, if you've got an older home, how does the more recent environmental laws come into place? Like, do you have asbestos or lead paint? In many places, like here in my Portland area, if you have a house fire, for instance, and the house in a 1930s home makes it where they're going to have to tear the house down, they've just changed the law, so that has to be hand dismantled and things to be required to be recycled after the asbestos and lead paint are removed. So you could have a $60,000 bill just to tear the house down before you replaced it. So you need to make sure that you're covered and that you're kind of in lockstep to what's going on in your neighborhood and in your local laws for construction, because you could be, you know, you're already stressed going through this whole process of losing a house to some kind of catastrophe. The next thing is you don't want to realize that you're only going to get half the money out of it to put it back.
Yeah, which means you basically can't put it back.
You're right. Many people can't. And so that's one thing on top of all this. Just make sure you're properly insured with all of that. And right now, that's a big deal.
But I know you recently talked to our friend Caroline. Are there new environmental laws coming down the chute that people might need to be aware of?
You know, there's a lot of them out there. And when it comes to insurance like that, for instance, in my area here in the Portland, Oregon metro area, if I have a house that was built prior to 2004, if I take anything, any building materials to the dump out of there, it has to be tested for asbestos. So you have to have now an asbestos survey on your home before you do stuff. So if you've got a, you know, a flood, a house fire, you need to start putting those costs into it. And to be honest, make sure your policy covers that kind of stuff, because if you have some 1970s asbestos or even 80s or 90s asbestos, are you properly covered, or are you going to be paying for that abatement out of your own pocket because the insurance isn't going to cover it?
That's such a great point, Eric. And back to kind of what Craig brought up about value and protesting your taxation values. That is something, you know, Texas is a non-disclosure state, right? And so you can contest the value based on the fact that they don't have public record of the exact sales price, right? So they don't gather that information and use it. We are kind of here waiting on the market to either balance or, you know, the interest rates to change and let us know whether the market is going to balance or whether this is a true uptick in market. You know, before we can really determine whether those values are out of range or whether they are, you know, right on spot. So just a little side note there.
Now, that's a great point. Right next door to me, kind of across the flag lot driveway of my house, a house was bought here this last summer. Developer came in, tore that down, put a big house on that under quarter acre lot. He went to go list that in December, pulled it off the market before it fully listed, and he's been marking that thing up since December. Well, he was going to list it at 1.5. He's now adding $100,000 a month. I think it get listed tomorrow at 1.9, and that's the kind of volatility that we have in my market, in my area. And it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out in the short term and the long term, especially when it comes to affordable housing and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Affordable housing is kind of a laughable term in some areas these days, right?
Oh, it's tough. I mean, we've got some things that happened here in my state, for instance, which is going to be interesting to see how it plays out through the legal system and everything else. They basically eliminated residential zoning requirements across the state. So if you were in a certain zoning category, you could put, you know, mass density on your lot, even though it's not zoned that way. They've basically here in 2 years are going to eliminate residential zoning and density stuff to increase density in the metropolitan areas. And so they're forcing cities and counties to go to a pack them in kind of mentality. And I think it's going to be an interesting one to see how that plays out. I think there's going to be a lot of lawsuits. I think it's going to be good for some people, and I think it's going to be interesting when it comes to historical homes and things like that. If people start coming in and putting in 12 plexes where a beautiful, you know, historic home that was on a historic register is, I think we're going to see some interesting battles here over the next few years.
You can just come to Houston and watch how that plays out. It's already happening.
Gotcha. Yeah, it's we're just right there right now, so it's going to be interesting. And I love ADUs. I mean, there's some great ADUs where people are putting in the tiny homes and micro homes in the backyards and making those with an alley access for rentals and in-law suites and things like that. I think there's a lot of great things we can do with that. Some of the issues we're running into, though, is parking and some of those other things that definitely are changing livability for some of these people.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about with the ADUs is definitely changing the way, like, for here in Houston, for example. I know when you were talking about, you know, historic homes being removed, I know down in the Heights right now, which is kind of a historic area of downtown Houston, like, there's all those historic homes for the most part are just being bulldozed, and then they're, you know, in their place, they're putting either, you know, really tall three-story homes on where there used to be one home. They can now put, you know, three to four. And if they're not doing that, then you're getting those ADUs in the back where people are, you know, because there is no zoning in Houston, that they can just do those kinds of things. They can build whatever they want in those places. And so people are taking advantage of those opportunities and, you know, trying to, you know, create some passive income off of, you know, existing real estate.
Yeah, that's a great point.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the legal, you know, ramifications that could come from, you know, that mass packing in of the populations, because, you know, on the real, you know, retail end, right, we can see the benefit of it, and on the humanitarian end of it, we can see the benefit of it and the adverse effects. But also, you know, we don't always have our finger on that, you know, deeper pulse of the legal realm of things, like Michael has said earlier too. I'm curious if he has any comments on this.
Sorry, I'm emailing. I need a refresher as what we're talking about.
ADUs, accessory dwelling units, on properties. And then Eric mentioned in the Portland metro where he is, they are taking away residential. How did you state that, Eric? Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's interesting. You know, with the ADUs that are coming in, people are tearing down larger homes to put in, you know, multiple units in those places. I think you're going to start seeing some neighbors complaining and filing lawsuits about density and lack of parking and things like that in the neighborhoods. You know, are there any legal ramifications that you see as a homeowner, Michael, that you could see, or ways to get around that in the neighborhood from your, you know, your experience in Arizona, at least?
No, if the property owner is permitted to do what they want to do, you're not going to be able to stop them.
That's exactly what I thought.
And here's even worse for those others out there that don't like that answer. If the property owner's got money, it's definitely going to happen.
Yeah, we saw that in L.A. area where a billionaire was building a house, got a house for, I think it was a permit for a 10,000-square-foot house, and built a, you know, one five times the size up there. And I think it took about 8 years for them to even go through the legal process, and they didn't get permits for all that. And they finally, I think, lost in the I don't know if it was Bel Air or Beverly Hills was forcing them to tear the whole thing down because it was not built to code either. But it was an ugly public legal battle down there, and it was an interesting case to watch over time.
So it's kind of interesting, and someone a little bit ago had mentioned something about this. And the comment was, it definitely pays a few dollars to or want to do your due diligence as opposed to finding out you have a problem later. And my comment to that story is that's how I bought my own personal residence. I bought my house via foreclosure, and the bank that was selling my property was claiming that my property was built over the property line and that a portion of my house had to be knocked down, and therefore that's why they were selling it at a pretty big discount. And that could have all been avoided had they spent a few hundred dollars and had a lawyer like myself review the documents, basically the CC&Rs in my neighborhood, to see what the actual rules were. And I've never knocked down that portion of my house that I bought because they were wrong. And they sold the house to me at a significant discount because of it. And I mean, like a third off the normal price. And that's all because they didn't want to spend $1,000 to do some due diligence. And so, and reverting back to what was said before, it is definitely a good idea if you are unsure about something or you want to make sure you have the future use rights, get someone to look at your documents and just make sure that, you know, what you can do moving forward is permitted.
That is a great point. Well, guys, we're at the top of the hour here. Did we have any more questions before we look at wrapping this room up and getting everybody back to work and doing some of their other stuff that they're doing?
Not really. I just wanted to highlight that last point that Michael brought up about, you know, specifically if your property is in an HOA, making sure that, you know, if you're a realtor, we don't have that legal background. We can review it. We can look at it, but we don't want to. It's not our job. It's the property owner's job. It's the attorney's job. So we do need to like triple encourage them to, you know, get legal counsel on that. And I'm actually currently in the process of trying to figure out a way to partner with an attorney to where we can have representation for buyers and sellers with every deal I do. So it's kind of an ending thought there.
Sounds like a good plan to me. In my opinion, it's never a bad idea to have a good attorney on your side. And if we don't have any more questions, if you haven't, you know, joined the Around the Home Club, we're here every Thursday at 11 Central Standard Time. I encourage you to follow the club so you can see every time we jump up here on Clubhouse. And also, if you haven't followed the mods and everybody up on the stage, give them a follow. I know they'll give you a follow back. So we can see each other when we're in interesting and, you know, just fun topics all across Clubhouse. So anybody else got anything before we sign this thing off?
All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining us today on Around the Home. We appreciate it. And each week we're going to have a new and interesting subject based around your home. special thanks to Craig and Kevin from the Homeowner Show. Those guys have a great show out there. Take a look at it. Something else for you to grab in home improvement podcasting. All right, everybody, that's what Clubhouse is about. That's what it sounds like. That's what you're missing out on. Make sure and join us on Thursday, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And we'll be talking homes again over there. Just look for the Homeowner Show. And you can find me, Eric Gorenson. You'll find me on there. Follow me as well. And that way you get notified anytime we jump up and do something. All right, everybody, have a great rest of the week. Happy Wednesday. Thanks for listening to Around the House.
Around the House with Eric G. is produced by Designed by Eric G. in association with Salem Media and distributed nationally by the Sun Broadcast Group. All rights reserved. Copyright 2020 Designed by Eric G. We will be back next week. If you missed part of the show, check out the podcast of all of our shows at AroundTheHouseOnline.com. Remember, measure with a micrometer, mark with caulk, and cut with an axe. Thanks for listening to Around the House.
Hey, it's Eric G. from Around the House. Are you planning a decking or siding project this year? If you are, you've got to check out my friends at Millboard. Millboard is a completely different kind of composite decking and cladding that enhances outdoor spaces with enduring distinction. Hand-molded from the finest oak, it realistically mimics the natural grain and color of premium hardwood. If you're looking for something that doesn't look like plastic and instead real wood, check out Millboard.com. Make sure and check out that interview we did just a few weeks back. That's Millboard.com.